could have spread my wings and done a thousand things I've never done before. I'll never know what made it so exciting. What all at once my heart took flight.
Pickering, I don't understand. Do you mean that my son is coming to Ascot today?
Yes, Mrs. Higgins. As a matter of fact, he's here.
What a disagreeable surprise. Ascot is usually the one place I can come to with my friends and not run the risk of seeing my son Henry. Whenever my friends meet him, I never see them again.
Well, he had to come, Mrs. Higgins. You see, he's taking the girl to the annual embassy ball, and, well, he wanted to try her out first.
I beg your pardon?
You know, the annual embassy ball.
Yes, I know the ball, but what girl?
Oh, didn't I mention that?
No, you did not.
Oh, it was quite simple, really. One night I went to the opera at Covent Garden to hear one of my favourite operas, Aida. And as I was coming out, incidentally, they didn't do Aida that night. No, they did Götterdämmerung. I'd never heard Götterdämmerung before. By George, that's a rackety one. when the tenor chap finally
left. What about the girl, Colonel?
Oh, yes, yes. As I was coming out, I met your son, Henry, who in turn met Miss Doolittle, who now lives with Henry.
Lives with Henry? Is it a love affair?
Oh, no. Heavens knows, no. She's a flower girl. He picked her up off the curbstone.
A flower girl?
Yeah. Yes, Higgins said to me, Pickering, you see this girl, in 6 months I could make a duchess of her. I said, nonsense. He came right back with, yes, I can. All right, I said, I'll make a bet with it that you can't. And I did, and he is.
But, Colonel, I still don't understand.
The horses are leaving the paddock, Mrs. Higgins.
Excuse me, Mrs. Higgins, I must fetch her.
But, Colonel, am I to understand that my husband is bringing a flower girl to Ascot?
Yes, Mrs. Higgins, that's it, precisely. Jolly good, Mrs. Higgins, jolly good.
You'd better stay close to the car, Charles. I may be leaving abruptly.
Thank you. which one are you?
Ah, mother! Have you seen Pickering?
My, you look nice.
I saw Colonel Pickering, and Henry, dear, I am most provoked. I've heard you've brought a common flower girl from Covent Garden to my box at Ascot.
Oh, darling, she'll be all right. I've taught her to speak properly. And she's strict instructions as to her behavior. She's to stick to two subjects, the weather and everyone's health. Sort of fine day and how'd you do and that sort of thing, and not just let herself go on things in general. Help her along, darling. You'll be quite safe.
Safe? To talk about our health in the middle of a race?
Well, she's got to talk about something.
Henry, you're not even dressed properly.
I changed my tie.
Oh, where's the girl now?
Being pinned.
Pinned?
Yes. Some of the clothes we bought her didn't quite fit properly. I told Pickering we should have taken her with us.
You're a pretty pair of babies playing with your live doll. Oh, Mrs. Eynsford Hill.
Mrs. Higgins.
Oh, damn, are all these people with you?
Mrs. Higgins, is this your celebrated son?
I'm sorry to say my celebrated son has no manners. He may be the life and soul of the Royal Society soirees, but he's rather trying on more commonplace occasions. You mustn't mind him.
I don't.
Mother.
Ah, Colonel Pickering, you're just in time for tea.
Thank you, Mrs. Higgins. May I introduce Miss Eliza Doolittle?
My dear Miss Doolittle.
How kind of you to let me come.
Delighted, my dear. Mrs. Eynsford Hill, Miss Eynsford Hill, Miss Doolittle.
How do you do?
How do you do?
Lord and Lady Boxington, Miss
How
Doolittle.
How do you do?
Sir Reginald
How do you do?
Sir Reginald Tarrington.
How do you do?
How do you do?
And Freddie Eynsford Hill.
How do you do?
How do you do?
Miss Doolittle?
Good afternoon, Professor Higgins.
The first race was ever so exciting, Miss Doolittle. I'm so sorry you missed it.
Will it rain, do you think?
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
Olé!
In Hartford, Hereford, and Hampshire, hurricanes hardly ever happen.
How awfully funny.
What is wrong with that, young man? I bet I got it right.
Smashing!
I do hope we don't have any unseasonably cold spells. It brings on so much influenza, and our whole family is susceptible to it.
My aunt died of influenza. So they said, but it's my belief they done the old woman in.
Done her in?
Yeah. Yes, Lord, love you. Why should she die of influenza when she come through diphtheria right enough the year before? Fairly blue with it she was. They all thought she was dead. But my father, he kept ladling gin down her throat. Then she come to so sudden, she bit the bowl off the spoon.
Dear me.
Now, what call would a woman with that strength in her have to die of influenza? And what become of her new straw hat that should have come to me? Somebody pinched it. And what I say is, them as pinched it done her in.
Done her in? Done her in, did you say?
Yes, it's the new small talk. To do a person in means to kill them.
But you surely don't believe your aunt was killed?
Do I not? Them she lived with would have killed her for a hat pin, let alone a hat.
But it can't have been right for your father to keep pouring spirits down her throat like that. But it might have killed her.
Not her. Gin was mother's milk to her. Besides, he'd poured so much down his own throat, he knew the good of it.
Do you mean to say he drank?
Drank? My word, something chronic. Here, what are you sniggering at?
The new small talk. You do it so awfully well.
If I was doing it proper, what was you laughing at? Have I said anything I oughtn't?
Not at all, my dear.
Well, that's a mercy anyhow. What I always say
is...
I don't
know if this is enough time before the next race. There's a better cup, my dear.
Well, I have a bet on number 7. I should be so happy if you would take it. You'll enjoy the race ever so much more.
That's very kind of you.
His name is Dover.
Dover.
There they are again, lining up to run. Now they're holding steady, they are ready.
Officer, I know this is Wimpole Street, but could you tell me where 27A is?
Right there, sir.
Oh, thank you. Oh, are those for sale?
Yes, sir. 2 for 2d.
Here's a shilling.
Thank you kindly, sir.
Isn't it a heavenly day?
When she mentioned how her aunt bit off the spoon, she completely dug me in, and my heart went on a journey to the moon. When she told about her father and the gin, and I never saw a more enchanting farce than the moment when she shouted, "Move your blooming!"
Is Miss Doolittle at home?
Whom shall I say is calling?
Freddy Eynsford Hill. If she doesn't remember me, tell her I'm the chap who was sniggering at her.
Yes, sir.
Oh, and would you give her these?
Yes, sir.
You You needn't rush. I want to drink in this street where she lives.
Yes.
I have often walked down this street before, but the pavement always stayed beneath my feet before. All at once am I, several stories high, knowing I'm on the street where you live. Are the lilac trees in the heart? A lock in any other part of town. Does enchantment pour out of every door? No, it's just on the street where you live. And though the towering feeling just alone somehow. Suddenly appear. People stop and stare, they don't bother me. There's nowhere else on earth that I would rather be. Let the time go by, I won't care if I can be here on the street where you.
Sorry, sir. Miss Doolittle says she never wants to see anyone ever again.
But why? She was magnificent.
Magnificent? Do you have the right address, sir?
Of course. Tell her I'll wait.
But it may be days, sir, even weeks.
But don't you see? I'll be happier here.
People stop and stare. They don't bother me. For there's nowhere else on earth that I would rather be. Let the time go by. I won't care if I can be here on the street where you live.
Higgins, if there's any mishap at the embassy tonight, if Miss Doolittle suffers any embarrassment, whatever, it's entirely on your head alone. I've been begging you to call off this experiment ever since Ascot.
Eliza can do anything.
I suppose she's discovered. I suppose she makes another ghastly mistake.
There were no horses at the ball, Pickering.
Think how agonizing it would be. God, if anything happened, I don't know what I'd do.
Well, you could always rejoin your regiment.
There's no time for flippancy, Higgins. The way you've driven her these last 6 weeks has exceeded all the bounds of... For God's sake, Higgins, stop pacing up and down. Can't you settle somewhere?
Have some port. It will quieten your nerves.
I'm not nervous. Where is it?
On the desk.
The car is here, sir.
Ah, thank you, Mrs. Pierce. Are you helping Eliza?
Yes, sir.
Helping it indeed, but the damn gown doesn't fit. I warned you about those French designers. We should have gone to a good English store where we knew everybody was on our side. Have some port.
No, thank you.
Are you so sure she'll retain all you've hammered into her?
We shall see.
Well, I suppose she doesn't.
Well, then I lose my bet.
You know what I can't stand about you, Higgins, is your confounded complacency. In a moment like this, with so much at stake, it's utterly indecent that you don't need a little port. What about the girl? You act as if she doesn't matter at all.
Oh, rubbish, Pickering. Of course she matters. What on earth do you think I've been doing all these months? What could possibly matter more than to take a human being and change her into a different human being by creating a new speech for her? Why, it's filling up a deepest gulf that separates class from class and soul from soul. Oh, she matters immensely.
And with Eliza's entrance ready for the ball in shimmering white silk and fur, we reach the end of Act One of Lerner and Lowe's My Fair Lady. Annalene Beachy is Eliza Doolittle. Anthony Andrews, Professor Henry Higgins. James Fleet, Colonel Hugh Pickering. And Jenny Galloway, Mrs. Pierce. At Ascot, we encountered Sian Phillips as Mrs. Higgins and Julian Ovenden as Freddie Eynsford Hill. Alan Armstrong plays Alfred P. Doolittle. John Wilson conducts the John Wilson Orchestra. Well, as you may have realised during the applause and laughter here at the Royal Albert Hall, all sorts of visual gags going on, including a machine that shoots flames high into the air when H is properly pronounced. And lots of funny walks, long faces and physical tricks during that grand social meeting at the races. Well, if you've just joined us, welcome. It's the second night of the BBC Proms in a weekend when the stage is very much to the fore, as Sir John Eliot Gardiner conducting Debussy's Pelléas et Mélisande tomorrow evening. Every prom is preceded by an event across the road at the Royal College of Music, and we're going to bring you highlights of Proms Plus throughout the season here on Radio 3. In fact, that's what we're going to do right now for the next 20 minutes before Act 2 of My Fair Lady. My Fair Lady is based on George Bernard Shaw's play Pygmalion, which was the subject of tonight's Proms Plus, chaired by Matthew Sweet.
Tonight's prom is a musical theatre masterpiece from 1956, but it's based on material as old as the hills, specifically the hills on the island of Cyprus, where Ovid laid the tale of Pygmalion, the sculptor who loved his work so much he married it. In 1912, George Bernard Shaw hitched his name to the story. And it's now hard to think of Pygmalion and his creation Galatea without thinking of Professor Henry Higgins and the woman whom he tries to remake, Eliza Doolittle. We're going to explore the play with a cast whose names anyone would be happy to see in lights. Shaw's biographer, Michael Holroyd, and the historian, Roy Foster, and bringing the play to life for us are the actors Rachel Sterling and Tim Pigott-Smith. Could we have found anyone better? Not bloody likely. In the myth of Pygmalion, the goddess Venus intervenes to bring life to an ivory statue, and everybody sort of lives reasonably happily ever after. Roy, what is Higgins' project? What does he want to do for or to Eliza?
Higgins' project is generally seen as a project based on class. He's going to get an uneducated flower girl and teach her to speak such perfect received English that she'll be mistaken for a duchess. He'll win his bet. But the question is, what'll happen to her? And that is what makes the play so fascinating, because what happens to her is that she turns out to be a creature of great natural intelligence and resource. And unlike in Pygmalion, she's not going to marry him, and she's going to find out the limitations of moving up a class and actually also losing your means of work. English people want this play to be about class. Shaw was an Irishman, and the Irish are much more interested in economics than class.
Michael, in the introduction, Shaw says that didactic plays are the only kind that are worth bothering with, really. What does he want to teach us?
The danger of being too didactic is one of the things I think he teaches us, and the fact that it's very difficult to have human relationships with people who you are teaching in a rather unsympathetic but expert way.
Roy, you said that you're rather disavowing the idea that class was an important part of that story, but surely, you know, this play is a product of 1912. This is a pretty kind of febrile time, isn't it, for questions of class and of gender?
Yes, it is, and of course class is a large part of it because class and economics are intertwined. But you say 1912, Matthew, that's quite true. It's the time of the suffragette thing. It's the time when street traders are actually a very hot news issue. And it's a time when prostitution is a very hot issue. Shaw is fascinated by prostitution. Back to Pygmalion. Why does the sculptor in Ovid's fable want to make a fake woman? Because he believes all real women are whores. And why does Eliza keep saying, I'm a good girl, I'm a good girl? Why does she know what it means when somebody takes down something about her? The note taker is not who is Higgins actually taking down her voice pronunciation in the first act. She thinks that he's going to have her for soliciting men on the street. Shaw has already written a campaigning play about prostitution, Mrs. Warren's profession, in which he says, or I think probably in the preface he says, the prostitution isn't about men's licentiousness and women's depravity. It's about women of a certain class being undervalued, underpaid, and overworked. And that is, in a sense, the kind of economics that Liza's position is coming from. That's why I think it's a much more interesting play than I'm afraid My Fair Lady makes it out to be, which is all about class and romance.
Okay, well, let's have our first piece of performance from the play, which pits Professor Higgins against his creator, his mother, Mrs. Higgins, who will be played tonight by Rachel Sterling, and Professor Higgins by Tim Pigott-Smith.
I've picked up a girl.
Does that mean some girl has picked you up?
Not at all. Oh, God, I don't mean a love affair.
You're what a pity.
Why?
Well, you never fall in love with anyone under 45. When will you discover there are some rather nice-looking young women about?
Oh, I can't be bothered with young women. My idea of a lovable woman is something as like you as possible. Oh. I shall never get into the way of seriously liking young women. Some habits lie too deep to be changed. Besides, they're all idiots.
Do you know what you would do if you really loved me, Henry?
No bother, what? Marry, I suppose.
No, stop fidgeting and take your hands out of your pockets. That's a good boy. Now, tell me about the girl.
Well, she's coming to see you.
I don't remember asking her.
You didn't. I asked her. If you'd known her, you wouldn't have asked her.
Indeed? Why?
Well, it's like this. She's a common flower girl. I picked her off the curbstone.
And invited her to my at home?
No, that'll be all right. I've taught her to speak properly. And she has strict orders as to her behaviour. She has to keep to two subjects, the weather and everybody's health. Fine day, and how do, you know, and not let herself go on things in general. That'll be safe.
Safe? To talk about our health, about our insides, perhaps about our outsides? How could you be so silly, Henry?
Thanks very much indeed, Tim Pigott-Smith and Rachel Sterling. Michael, would it be wrong to go looking for aspects of Shaw's biography in this relationship? Is his mother present here?
Well, biographers, of course, always think that this is relevant and is there. Higgins is not a pen portrait of Shaw, but he has, as I say, the same predicament. The good news is that Shaw loved his mother. The bad news is that she couldn't care for him at all. Not at all. And when she eventually left Dublin to go to London in the early 1870s, when Shaw, her son, was 15, 16. She took her two daughters, and she left him with his semi-drunkard father, out-of-work father. And he felt for the rest of his life, really, in one way, that he was unlovable. He would have to create a new person outside himself called GBS, a public figure, who had, if not love, a lot of attention, and eventually quite a lot of money. And I think that this is at the center of this play. And what is strange outside the play is the first person he actually made love to, in the way that we would understand the word, was to his mother's best friend, someone who was over 45, and after his father had died, and he bought, with the money from his father's will, a new set of clothes, a new suit, from which he turned up. So it was really like the father and the mother all over again, only better this time.
Roy, that change jangling that we hear in that scene, what's that all about?
Well, it's probably about some form of sexual release, if you really want to look at it that way, because Higgins' sexuality is strangely arrested, and the exchange with his mother, in a sense, shows that. What Michael says is fascinating, because one of the stage directions for Mrs. Higgins is when she realizes it's her son who's come to see her, she is dismayed. You know, there's a rejection there. He has a form of what I might call, and I am an academic, academic Asperger's syndrome. You know, it's very common in places like Oxford, and he was based on, well, not based, but partly inspired by an Oxford don of phonetics. He is a sort of child who fidgets, who plays, who wants to be a confirmed bachelor all his life, whose idea of a perfect outcome at the end is when he suggests to Eliza that she lives with him and his friend, Colonel Pickering, like three old bachelors. So there's something really rather strange going on here, which Michael is now going to come in.
There is a sexual subtext, I think, to it, and you get it not quite so much in the words, but it's in the stage directions. I'd like just to quickly read some. Eliza tries to control herself. She's on the point of screaming. He comes to her. He pulls her up. She crisps her fingers frantically, gives a suffocated scream of fury, and instinctively darts her nails into his face. Higgins, catching her wrists, he throws her roughly into an easy chair. Liza, crushed by superior strength and weight. Higgins, thundering. Liza, with bitter submission. There's something there.
But this is violence instead of love, which occurs throughout. And when he tells her, oh, all right, go off and marry someone, he says, marry some fool with a thick pair of lips to kiss you with and a thick pair of boots to kick you with. And that's his idea of marriage.
Which sounds like an excellent moment to go to the next performance from the play. Michael, you've chosen this scene from Act Four, a terrific argument between Eliza and Henry, a kind of lover's argument, although by this stage they're no such thing.
It's after the ball, so she's had a fantastic night and looks absolutely ravishing.
Diamond sparkling.
Well, it's over and done with, and now I can go to bed at last without dreading tomorrow. Good night. Put out the lights, Eliza. And tell Mrs. Pierce not to make coffee for me in the morning. I'll take tea. Oh, what the devil have I done with my slippers?
There are your slippers. And there. Take your slippers and may you never have a day's luck with them.
What on earth? What's the matter? Get up. Anything wrong?
Nothing wrong with you. I've won your bet for you, haven't I? That's enough for you. I don't matter, I suppose.
You won my bet, presumptuous insect. I won it. What did you throw those slippers at me for?
Because I wanted to smash your face. I'd like to kill you, you selfish brute. Why didn't you leave me where you picked me out of, in the gutter? You thank God it's all over and now you can throw me back again there, do you?
Yeah, the creature is nervous after all.
Ah!
Yeah, would you? Claws in, you cat. How dare you show your temper to me?
Sit down and be quiet.
What's to become of me? What's to become of me?
How the devil do I know what's to become of you? What does it matter what becomes of you?
You don't care. I know you don't care. You wouldn't care if I was dead. I'm nothing to you, not so much as them slippers.
Those slippers!
Those slippers! I didn't think it made any difference now.
So ferocious, isn't it, Michael?
This is very important to Shaw. In fact, he is rewriting a most important part of his early life. He was brought up in a ménage à trois. He had his father, George Shaw, who was the drunkard, and then there was this other man,